So picture a downpour, but not normal rain. I want you to imagine a really dense, acidic rain made entirely of just pure, blinding primary colors.
Right, like stark reds, intense yellows, those deep blues.
Exactly. A visual deluge that's so aggressive, so saturated, it actually looks like it's melting the physical world right in front of your eyes. Like the environment is just completely dissolving under the weight of it.
It creates this deeply unsettling visual chaos. I mean, you are basically looking at an environment that is actively collapsing.
Right. But then, and this is the hook your eye catches something else, dead in the center of all this chaotic meltdown, resting on an impossibly thin, razor-sharp horizontal line, is a flat, pitch-black shadow. It's
Yeah.
the silhouette of a bird. And it simply refuses to disappear. I mean, it isn't flapping its wings in a panic. It isn't, trying to flee the toxic rain. It is just calmly, stoically watching the world fall apart around it.
Which forces you to confront a massive psychological tension, right?
Right?
The contrast between that frenetic, destructive energy of the background and the absolute, unshakable stillness of that dark figure is just staggering.
It really is. And our mission for today's deep dive is to figure out exactly how that tension works. We are looking at a specific piece of art titled Cuervo, which translates to Raven by the artist Jairo Duque.
Yeah, and what appears, at first glance to be a relatively straightforward watercolor of a bird is actually this profound, heavily layered commentary on humanity, the natural world, and the friction between the two.
Totally. And what makes unpacking Cuervo so compelling for us is the unprecedented access we have to the creator's mind here.
Right, because normally when you stand in front of a piece of art hanging on a pristine gallery wall, you're completely separated from the artist. You kind of just have to project your own assumptions onto the canvas.
Yeah, you're just guessing. But instead, we have a backstage pass to the entire process. We are working from Dupe's comprehensive technical sheets, which, detail the exact chemical composition of his materials.
Which is rare on its own.
Oh, absolutely. And perhaps even more fascinating, we have his deeply personal, highly self-critical diary entries written after the painting was technically finished.
It's incredible access.
It really is. It's like standing on the sidewalk looking up at a gleaming, finished skyscraper while simultaneously reading the structural engineer's private journal that details, like, every hidden mathematical formula and secret doubt keeping the building from collapsing.
That's a great way to put it. And having those technical and emotional coordinates is vital because this artwork is about to undergo a massive geographical shift.
Right?
Because, Duke brought Cuervo to life in the absolute silent intimacy of his private studio in Whittier, California. But its destination is pretty much the complete opposite of that quiet sanctuary.
Yeah, in January of 2025, this piece is heading to the Art Boxy and Dakilova Gallery in Dubai.
Talk about a change of scenery.
Right. Taking something created in total vulnerable isolation and thrusting it onto a massive, noisy, glaringly bright international stage, that requires a certain kind of armor. You can't just put an emotionally heavy, structurally demanding manifesto on a flimsy piece of paper and expect it to survive.
No, definitely not. And that transition from the quiet studio to the global stage relies entirely on the literal physical foundation the artist chose. His technical sheets specify that he painted this on 640-gram cold-pressed coarse-grain Arches paper.
Okay, so unless you spend your weekends like wandering the aisles of a specialty art supply store, 640 grams probably doesn't mean anything to you.
Fair point, yeah.
So for context, standard office paper, the kind sitting in your printer right now, is about 75 grams. And
Wow.
even if you buy premium, high-quality watercolor paper, you're usually looking at a maximum weight of about 300 grams.
Right, so it's more than double that.
Exactly. So when he selects 640 gram paper, he is working with a material that behaves less like paper and way more like a structural wall.
And the physical mechanics of that paper are absolutely crucial to the painting's survival. That massive weight rating means the manufacturer has compacted an incredibly dense volume of cotton fibers into a single sheet.
Because fiber density matters, right?
Oh, massively. It dictates how a material responds to trauma, which in this case is the trauma of water. When an artist floods a surface with the sheer volume of water required to create that melting, chaotic background, a standard 300-gram paper will just warp.
It kind of buckles and bends.
Exactly. It creates those frustrating little undulating waves that permanently distort the perspective of the image. But a 640-gram paper simply absorbs the flood and holds its ground. It doesn't flinch at all.
Wow. And the technical sheets also note it is cold pressed. What does that actually mean for the painting?
So in paper manufacturing, if you press the wet fibers between hot rollers, you get a very smooth finish. But by using cold rollers, the natural rugged texture of the cotton is preserved. So under a microscope, the surface of this paper looks like a jagged geographical map. It has literal microscopic mountains and valleys.
Okay, I have to admit some confusion here, though. I always thought watercolor was basically just, you know, dyed, tinted water. It's this famously fragile, unpredictable medium. Why does the paper need microscopic mountains and valleys for tinted water?
Well, that assumption is true for standard, student-grade watercolors, which often rely on fine synthetic dyes.
Oh.
But Duke didn't use fine dyes. His notes reveal he used specific Daniel Smith watercolors that are formulated from heavy crushed minerals.
Wait, really? Actual ground-up stones?
Yeah, literally. He specifically chose them for a chemical phenomenon known as granulation.
But how do heavy crushed minerals work in a fluid medium? Doesn't the pigment just blend together when you add water?
Not with granulating paints. Because the pigments are derived from actual ground minerals, the particles have varying physical weights. So when you mix these heavy pigments with a massive volume of water and flood, that cold-pressed paper...
Oh, I see where this is going. Gravity takes over.
Precisely. You trigger a physical separation. The heavy, dense mineral particles physically sink. They fall into those microscopic craters and valleys of the paper's coarse grain.
Leaving the lighter stuff behind.
Right. The lighter pigment particles stay suspended and float on the surface of the water. As the water slowly evaporates, it doesn't dry into a smooth, flat wash of color. It deposits the heavy minerals into those grooves, leaving behind a highly textured, mottled organic pattern.
And the visual impact of that chemical reaction is just staggering. When you look at Cuervo, you see this overwhelming sense of verticality in the background.
Yeah, the heavy pigments have literally been dragged downward by gravity.
Exactly. It physically mimics the process of earth erosion. You aren't just looking at a painting of a toxic rainstorm. You are looking at a geological event that chemically occurred on the surface of the paper.
The erosion is structural just as much as it is visual. The medium itself is acting out the destruction depicted in the painting.
That is wild. But, and this is the crazy part, the bird in the center isn't dissolving. The toxic rain is eroding everything around it, but the water seemingly stops right at the edges of the raven.
Right, and he achieves that absolute stillness through negative space and containment. He doesn't create the solidity of the bird by piling on layers of heavy paint. He creates it by establishing an invisible wall.
The water just isn't allowed to cross that line.
Exactly. The chaotic heavy water surges everywhere else, but it is halted at the exact boundary of the bird's silhouette. The total absence of that chaotic fluidity is what gives the figure its dense, immovable presence. It anchors the entire composition.
It keeps the visual structure from collapsing. I want to push back on the silhouette itself, though. Like, let's play devil's advocate for a moment.
Okay, go for it.
We, as observers, are heavily conditioned by centuries of art history to revere hyperrealism, you know. We expect a master artist to demonstrate their technical prowess by painting every single iridescent feather, every tiny claw, the exact glint of sunlight reflecting in the bird's eye.
Right, we want to see the skill on display.
Yeah. So when an artist with Duke's obvious technical capability chooses to paint, basically, a flat black blob, doesn't that feel a bit like a shortcut? Like, why should we be impressed by a lack of detail?
I mean, that reaction makes complete sense based on how we've been taught to consume art. However, this lack of detail is not a lack of skill. It is a highly intentional philosophical stance. In his notes, he refers to this deliberate restraint as an economy of resources.
Meaning he's using only what is strictly necessary to communicate the idea.
Right.
But why is stripping away the detail necessary here?
To answer that, we have to look at the history of how humans paint animals. Think about Grand Victorian paintings or those elaborate Renaissance still lifes. Animals were almost always rendered in excruciating hyper-realistic detail.
Yeah, very dramatic and glossy.
And the reason for that intense detail is that the art was inherently anthropocentric. It was centered entirely on the human ego. The animals were painted as trophies.
Oh.
Yeah. The artist captured every single feather, so the human viewer could feel a sense of ownership and dominance over this magnificent beast on the canvas. It's essentially a practice of visual taxidermy.
Visual taxidermy? That is such a good phrase. The human ego demands a hyper-realistic copy of the animal to hang on the wall, completely divorced from its natural habitat, just to serve as a luxury decoration or, like, a testament to human skill.
Exactly. And by explicitly refusing to spectacularize the raven, Duke rejects that entire anthropocentric tradition. When you strip the bird of his zoological details, the glossy feathers, the sharp beak, the eyes, you remove the human ability to consume it as a trophy.
You leave behind an archetype instead.
Right. So the economy of resources isn't just about saving paint. It is about granting the animal autonomy. It exists solidly for itself, not to dazzle a human audience.
That completely changes the vibe of the piece, because once you understand that the bird is not a mounted trophy, its presence against that chaotic background shifts dramatically. It takes on a much darker, much more urgent environmental weight.
It really does.
And let's focus on that environment again for a second. The background is composed of primary colors, reds, yellows, blues. Normally, in art or design, primary colors are vibrant, they feel foundational, almost cheerful. But the emotional resonance here is deeply uncomfortable.
Yeah, and his personal notes reveal he definitely did not view these colors as cheerful. He actually describes the palette as an open wound.
An open wound, wow.
Yeah. It is this frenetic, strident representation of an environment that has been fundamentally altered, polluted, and exhausted by destructive anthropogenic or human-driven action.
A bleeding landscape.
Yeah.
And right in the center of this wounded environment sits the raven. Now, if you say the word raven to anyone, a flood of cultural baggage instantly comes to mind, right?
Oh, sure. Edgar Allan Poe, mostly.
Exactly. Thanks to Poe and centuries of Gothic folklore, we are deeply conditioned to view this specific bird as a spooky herald of doom, a scavenger, or a harbinger of death. So when you put a symbol of death in the middle of a toxic, dying landscape, the conclusion seems kind of obvious.
Yet the artist explicitly rejects that Gothic cliche in his writings. The bird in Cuervo is not bringing death, nor is it a victim waiting to die. He redefines the raven as a sentinel, a watchman.
A watchman who doesn't seem to be doing much watching, though. I mean, it's just a flat shadow.
Well, look at its posture on that razor-thin line. It isn't aggressively opening its beak to fight off the acidic rain, and it hasn't spread its wings in a panic to escape the destruction. Its greatest, most profound act of resistance is the simple, stoic act of remaining.
It just refuses to yield its space.
Right. That unmoving black silhouette represents the deep geological memory of the ecosystem itself. It embodies how natural environments stoically endure. They dig their roots in and struggle to hold their ground, attempting to maintain their balance even when the habitat surrounding them becomes overwhelmingly hostile due to human interference.
It is the ultimate staring contest. The environment is chemically melting down, the world is dissolving into a chaotic blur, but the sentinel refuses to blink. It holds the line.
It really does.
Now, you would think, after successfully executing such a heavy, layered manifesto, especially one that is going to be shipped across the world to a gallery in Dubai, the artist would wash his brushes, step back, and just feel a sense of finality.
You'd think so, but the source material proves otherwise. A true creator is rarely granted the piece of finality.
Yeah, the post-completion diary entries we mentioned earlier are fascinating because they reveal a mind still actively wrestling with a finished canvas. The painting is dry, but his internal critique is just beginning.
And what really stands out in those diary entries is that his doubts are not focused on the complex, chaotic background. All of his retrospective anxiety is centered on the empty void, the deep black space behind the bird, and the stark edges of the silhouette itself.
He writes about wondering if he should have employed a technique like Sumato.
Which is such an interesting debate to have with yourself.
Right. For context, Sumato is a classic Renaissance technique, most famously used by Da Vinci, actually, where you heavily blur and soften the borders between objects so there are no harsh lines. So Duke debated whether he should have blurred the sharp, definitive boundary between the raven's solid form and the dark abyss surrounding it.
Which is wild to think about mechanically.
Yeah, how would you even achieve that on 640-gram paper that has already locked heavy mineral pigments into its microscopic valleys?
I mean, it would have been an incredibly risky mechanical intervention. To achieve a Sumato effect with this specific chemistry, he would have had to delicately re-wet those compacted cotton fibers right at the edges of the bird, coaxing the heavy black pigments to bleed outward into the surrounding chaos without turning the whole area into a muddy, undefined puddle.
So did he just choose structural safety over artistic experimentation?
Not exactly. The diary suggests the hesitation was largely psychological. Blurring those edges wouldn't have just been a stylistic tweak. It would have fundamentally altered the entire psychological narrative of the painting.
Ah, because it changes how the viewer's brain interprets the physical state of the bird.
Correct. If the border between the solid bird and the chaotic background is blurred, you, the observer, become completely unsure of the bird's trajectory.
Right.
Like, is the raven slowly emerging and materializing out of the dark void?
Right.
Or is the toxic rain actively devouring the bird, dissolving its edges until it is completely swallowed by the abyss?
Wow. It turns a statement of solid, unwavering endurance into this highly ambiguous question of survival. I mean, it cranks the dramatic tension way up, but it sacrifices the steadfastness of the watchman.
Exactly. And that wasn't his only lingering doubt. He also wrote about a desire to have gone back into the flat black silhouette itself to add barely perceptible nuances, like subtle microscopic shifts in tone hidden deep within the darkness.
Why would he want to do that?
Well, he was chasing a nearly impossible balance. He wanted to enrich the massive, heavy presence of the figure, giving it internal depth, while simultaneously being terrified of losing that flat, archetypal quality we discussed earlier. He was acutely aware of the danger of falling back into visual taxidermy.
Right, because the moment you start adding too much nuance, you invite the human ego back in to consume the details.
Exactly.
It is a beautiful testament to the creative process, really. It proves that in the mind of the artist, a painting never actually dries. There is always an open door, a lingering ghost of what if, that haunts the studio long after the crate has been shipped out.
And furthermore, that internal questioning, that lingering sense of unease from the artist, it doesn't just stay in the studio.
Yeah.
It naturally transfers directly to you, the observer, when you finally stand in front of the piece in that brightly lit Dubai gallery.
Let's actually put ourselves in that gallery space for a second. Normally, we approach art, and honestly, we approach nature operating under a very specific, somewhat arrogant power dynamic.
Yeah, for sure.
We assume we are the active subjects. We are the ones doing the observing, the evaluating, the judging. The painting, or the animal it depicts, is merely an inert object waiting patiently to be consumed by our gaze.
Right. We expect to be the masters of the interaction. But Cuervo is specifically engineered to flip that script on you.
It induces a very deliberate discomfort. When you stand there analyzing this serene, unmoving black figure balancing on a razor-thin line amidst a melting, wounded environment, you suddenly realize the dynamic has shifted. You aren't just looking at the bird.
The bird is looking back at you.
Yes. You are confronted by the immensity of the natural world evaluating its observer. It strips away the human arrogance of the gallery setting and forces a deeply uncomfortable realization.
Which is, who is the actual outsider in this exchange? Is it the stoic bird holding its precarious balance despite the chaos? Or is it humanity arriving with our endless capacity for destruction and our expectation that nature should just sit still and look pretty for us?
It really takes the experience from just, you know, looking at a nice watercolor to feeling like you are actively being judged by the geological memory of the earth itself.
It's powerful.
Which leads to a crucial question drawn directly from the tension in Duke's work. If we accept the premise that nature is this immense, patient archive, a sentinel quietly enduring our impacts and documenting the centuries and the very fibers of the planet, how will the chapter of human civilization ultimately be recorded in that physical archive?
I mean, consider what we are increasingly replacing that physical geological memory with. We are currently pouring the entirety of human history, culture, and ego into massive digital archives. We are training artificial intelligence models on our data, furiously building a pristine, weightless, synthetic memory of ourselves in the cloud.
All while simultaneously eroding and exhausting the physical earth to mine the heavy minerals and generate the massive power required to keep those data servers running. Will our ultimate legacy simply be a pristine digital ghost floating above a completely dissolved, toxic physical world? Or will we just go down in history as the overflow that finally forced this ancient sentinel to dissolve irreversibly into the dark void?
It's a heavy thought to sit with.
It is. So the next time you step outside and look at a piece of nature, whether it's a bird resting on a power line or a tree stubbornly cracking through city concrete, take a second to wonder if that ancient sentinel is quietly watching you back. Because somewhere, amidst an acidic rain of primary colors, a flat black shadow is sitting perfectly still, knowing its geological memory will outlast our digital one and calmly watching the collapse.